This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
There will be extinction, just as there's been extinction in the past from climate change. But there will be new evolution as well. And I think as humans, we need to learn from that design of adaptation to these changing conditions.
That's ecologist Amy Seidel. We talked to her about adapting to climate change in the first half of our show today.
People tell stories in a cadence, which is how we remember. You know, you think of nursery rhymes. I mean, the reason that they rhyme is so that we can remember.
And that's poet Nikki Giovanni. She's edited a new collection of hip-hop poetry for children. We'll talk to her about hip-hop poetry and hear tracks from the book CD later on. But first, Earth Day is celebrated this week. We wish it were celebrated every day. But in honor of this annual event, we talk with biologist Amy Seidel. She's the author of a new book that transcends the despair many of us feel when we think about the environmental catastrophes threatening the planet. She kindles a new sense of hope in the book, not for avoiding climate change, but for adapting to it with grace and ingenuity, and by relearning some of the older, wiser ways of adapting to the environment. Wiser ways people have had of adapting to the environment through the millennia. The book is Early Spring, An Ecologist and Her Children Wake to a Warming World. Amy Seidel and I sat down together in a small room at Mount Holyoke College just prior to a talk Seidel was giving to students and faculty in early April. When I talked with Amy Seidel, contrary to my usual practice, I had not read her book. I was just recovering from a bad cold and an extreme case of laryngitis. But being sick wasn't why I hadn't read her book before the interview. It had sat on my bedside table for several weeks while I battled my ambivalence. On the one hand, I was really eager to read it. On the other hand, I was afraid to. I was afraid that I was going to read yet another tract on our impending doom. Like many of us, I carry the constant sorrow of how we're imperiling our planet and our future. I don't want to think about what I'll have to say to my granddaughter when the full force of what my generation has done becomes clear to her. I put my dilemma to Amy Seidel.
I appreciate that, Francesca. You know, I have two small children myself, two daughters, ages 4 and 7, and I'm often asked how I speak to climate change, about climate change to them. In fact, I'm actually writing a book for children right now about climate change, and very different from a purely scientific piece, it is a story, because children love stories. We all love stories, but we learn to love stories as children. And I think the story of climate change for children is everything is changing, and yet we have to adapt. And so when I write in early spring about these signs and these signals from the landscape right where we live, in our backyards, in the forests where we go, in the streams where we play, in the gardens that we cultivate every year, it is to simultaneously respect and see the beauty in the world as it is now, and to anticipate the changes that are coming.
I asked Seidel if that world would have beauty as well.
Absolutely. It will have beauty. And I think it will be increasingly beautiful the more we appreciate the need to adapt. You know, I can look around right now and read about natural systems that are already adapting and that are showing adaptive capacity, either because there's genetic change or because there's a kind of plasticity, a flexibility in their organisms, in their individuals, to adapt to these shifting conditions. Now, certainly the science shows that there's going to be real change for species. There's the range of their species will change. They'll be distributed differently on the landscape. And there will be extinction, just as there's been extinction in the past from climate change. But there will be new evolution as well. And I think as humans, and as living organisms, we need to learn from that design of adaptation to maintain our own lives on this planet and to be similarly resilient in the face of these changing conditions.
Changing conditions are already being seen here in New England, earlier springs, later and warmer winters. I asked Amy Seidel, what are some of the changes in weather, climate, agriculture, and wildlife that we could expect?
Well, everything you just listed is changing, or aspects of it is changing. And it's people like you who have lived in a place for 25 years or maybe even 50 years, and diarists who have kept records of those changes that give us and provide us phenomenal information right now that we can judge today's events or these last 10 years' events against. So in terms of the actual changes, I start the book by talking about lilacs. And I'm speaking to you in April, and lilacs are around the corner to be blooming. I know the buds are swelling where I live. But in 1965, the USDA planted lilacs all around the Northeast. And they did it not because they were interested in climate change, but because they did it as a proxy, as a measurement of spring's advance for farmers. Well, what we know now from lilac flowering is that lilacs are flowering 2 days earlier per decade since 1965, or on average 8 to 16 days earlier since then. So the advent of spring is much earlier, as early as 16 days in some parts of the Northeast. That's considerable. In fact, in the book, because I have lilacs in my garden, I start to calculate when the lilacs might bloom for my children, and it is well before when they bloom now. So that's just one example. I'm coming from a landscape in Vermont where we too have seen sort of an average winter, and yet the year of 2008 is still a very warm year on record if we think about the whole planet. Even still, kind of an average winter. And yet on March 17th, I saw the first butterfly on a 60-degree day. Now, this is a butterfly I write about in early spring because it is an early arrival, and I usually see it in April sometime. But I saw it on April 1st, 2 years ago, and this year I saw it on March 17th. It's a small butterfly called the Pearl Crescent. Those are butterflies and plants, but there's any number of birds and insects. The Audubon Society just published a paper that showed things like all kinds of birds, robins, for instance, arriving 22 days earlier to places in the Northeast than they have. Male cardinals singing 15 days earlier in places. Again, because of people who've kept these long records, we can judge the changes against them. All told, songbirds are migrating far less distance because the conditions where they summer are all right in the wintertime. Boreal birds coming from the Arctic aren't flying as far south. The Carolina wren is rarely in Massachusetts now because it can exist at northern latitudes. So the bird species in particular, because they've been so well tracked, are a great indication of how early spring is and how the world is changing. The strong correlation is that these increases in temperature, these changes in precipitation, and the forecasted changes will continue to bring our systems into flux, and everything will respond.
It all seems kind of benign, the way Seidel talks about it. Early lilacs, warmer winters, longer growing season, bird species migrating less. Hey, that sounds pretty nice. But it's really not so benign.
I think if they come across as benign, it's a modest gift right now, because we have seen just the bit of change that we're sure to see over the coming century. Let me just clarify that by saying, you know, the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that are causing the warming, carbon dioxide among them, will not cease. Those are long-lived molecules that will be there for a long time. And as long as we put those emissions in the atmosphere, we will have warming for a long time, and it will increase. And so what we see right now is just the beginning of the changes, ones that are much more, will provide much more desperate situations for us in New England and beyond.
like more insect pests and weeds, and the potential end of such icons of New England agriculture as dairy farming, apples, and maple sugaring.
So in New England, I live with sugar makers, and it's true that birch, beech, maple forest is abundant there and abundant near where I live. And sugaring is changing. There's always climate or weather for sugar makers to contest with, but it's come earlier almost every year. In fact, when I was writing the book, people were sugaring in January one year because it was so warm, which is a very early year. People are starting to think sort of desperately about sugaring in the fall as a potential to make up for the loss in the spring. Now, there's all kinds of variability, and so we have to understand that the signal of change, while strong, will be played out over the next couple decades. And so these changes that we see may be true one year, and then not so true the next, and then greater again the following year. And that's the kind of signal of variation we need to respond to. The other thing I write about in the book are, as you mentioned, the fact that plants are changing. Not only are they changing their range, meaning where they occur on the landscape, but their chemistry is changing. A lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere allows plants to take up carbon dioxide, especially if they have nitrogen available. And for some plants, like poison ivy and ragweed, that makes them even better, even more poisonous, and even more dispersal of what's allergic to us. And so, yes, for sure, we're going to see real changes to our health because of the plant response to climate change. The other thing we're seeing is in insects, and as you mentioned it. Now, there's, you know, whenever you think of a forest or a lake, there's a modest amount of species, but then there are thousands, probably magnitudes more species interactions than just the species in the forest. All those interactions will change as those species change themselves. So what we know with mosquitoes right now, for instance, is that they are out earlier. Mosquitoes in the group Culex that actually carries West Nile virus and dengue fever, we see more of them in the United States coming up from the south, and we see them in northern latitudes like New England more because they're just not, they can deal with the temperatures because they're not as cold. Well, it turns out that those mosquitoes vector West Nile disease, West Nile virus, and robins are the host that the mosquitoes initially feed on. So when the robins have dispersed after nesting, the mosquitoes look for another host, and that is humans. So more and more we'll see tick outbreaks, West Nile virus outbreaks, as we've seen, other kinds of mosquito-vectored diseases. We'll see both in subtropical and in temperate areas where the mosquitoes are going. Finally, I'd just like to mention that the forests where I live in New England are full of other kinds of insects like forest caterpillars. And more what we're finding is that the cycles and the frequency of outbreak of forest insects is increasing. Like other insects, they're just not killed off by cold temperatures that occur in the winter. We just don't have them. In fact, the USDA is changing its zoning maps, right? Those maps that you can look at the back of a seed catalog and know whether you can plant a seed someplace. Well, we've just changed from zone 3 to zone 4, a much warmer temperature, because we don't see cold winters any longer. We can plant a lot more, but we can also harbor a lot more insects because they're not killed off by cold temperatures.
If here in New England we could be like Georgia, if we continue to follow the business as usual scenario with respect to carbon emissions, I wondered if the insect predators would move up along with the insects themselves.
Sure, in some cases we would see that, or we would see some transfer, you know, woodpeckers and other kinds of insectivores in our forest might feed more on these outbreaks. And that's true. We had this forest caterpillar outbreak in Vermont, and we found a predator came in and really reduced the population, and that's how it happened. But what we won't expect is for whole community assemblages to move together, right? So you're right, there are some models out there that show Vermont having the climate of Atlanta, Georgia, or Richmond, Virginia, more conservatively. That's a radical change with radical flux in the natural communities that we already exist. If we look back back to other climate change events, what we do not find is that those community assemblages stay intact. You know, they move at different rates, and new predators and new pests emerge. And it's very difficult to predict how those ecological changes are going to manifest on the landscape. We're starting to see some of this effect, certainly the occurrence of insects earlier, the blooming of species earlier, the mismatch between pollinators and their flowers is starting to happen. But how it ultimately plays out is still a big question for us.
This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. You're listening to an interview I did with environmental biologist and writer Amy Seidel about her new book, Early Spring, An Ecologist and Her Children Wake to a Warming World. We spoke at Mount Holyoke College earlier this month. I asked Seidel whether she talks to her children about climate change and what she tells them.
I have two daughters. They're ages 9 and 4, and so I talk differently to them. My 9-year-old is a fourth grader, is much more worldly than my young daughter. But as I mentioned, I really use the sense of story when I'm telling them about climate change. And also the opportunity. You know, when you're faced with something in your life that you can't reverse, knowing exactly the extent of that condition is sometimes helpful. You know, whether it's a health condition or bad news, you just want it all in front of you. Because as soon as you know what it is, it almost becomes transparent what you can do to ameliorate. That's what I find in my life. So what I see is the opportunity right now for a real transition in culture and in society. And I look forward to this transition because climate change is one aspect of a compromised situation that we're in, right? I've been thinking a lot about climate change and energy, but others are thinking about toxicity. Others are thinking about water availability. Others are thinking about other kinds of pollutions. So how do we look at this systemically and begin to develop an ethic and a new set of principles to live by? And that's actually where I want the conversation to go with my children. So whether it be that we're outside and planting peach trees, which we're going to do in another month's time, and is right in keeping with the change in zonation for us, because peaches are zone 4, and I've been zone 3 in my garden for the last long bit of time, the opportunity to talk about adaptation right there. We're planting peach trees because the climate is getting warmer. We do not want it to warm, but it is. So how do we lessen that effect and at times try to take advantage of it? Now, this is a difficult conversation because I don't want to leave the impression that anything is possible right now. But I do want to get across that adaptive capacity and resilience is possible. And we can see it in natural systems, right? There's going to be difficulty for sure, but the opportunity to build a new culture that is adaptive and is based on principles that doesn't get us in this trouble again, i.e. the complete misunderstanding of how our society, industrial society, is affecting the world, leads us to a new place and will ultimately evolve a new culture. And that's the opportunity we have now. So back to how I talk to my children is I not only try to engender in them the beauty of natural systems, but the beauty of the design of natural systems. Because it is in that design, I think, that we can base some of our adaptive capacity in time. I mean, we know, for instance, that life on the planet is, you know, 4.5 billion years old, if you include life in the oceans when we originated on the planet, or when life originated on the planet. And that life history has seen all kinds of changing conditions. We're talking about millions and millions of species and millions more interactions. If we're smart enough, we will look to those processes and products and interactions and the design, the evolutionary design in life itself, to think for ourselves how to adapt through these conditions. You know, when you plant something perennial, when you plant an orchard, for instance, a long-lived plant, you're looking for something that's like a forest. You know, orchards, you could say, let's make the analogy that orchards are like forests. Well, if you go to a forest, you find that there are plants at the base of forests that are providing nitrogen. Right? Maybe there are other plants that live in that forest that bring up good minerals like calcium or magnesium, right? There are pollinators that are specific to that forest that help, you know, pollinate those trees or disperse those seeds. That's a system that works well in producing and in nourishing itself. How do we develop an agriculture that's based on those same principles? How do we develop an agriculture that's self-replicating, that self-fertilizes, that pollinates because it's attractive to pollinators that are native to an area?
We depend on pollinators for many of our food crops, from apples to cucumbers, but many of them are under stress, like honeybees. I asked Seidel, what happens if there aren't any pollinators left? What happens if climate change outruns our ability to adapt? What then?
Yes, you know, what then? And it's very important to understand, you know, what the predictions are, how specific they can be, what their assumptions are. And I'm really not second guessing science. I'm just saying that it's still a young science, i.e. the science of climate modeling. Even still, I actually was in a room with the new NOAA head, Jane Lubchenco, last week, and she's talking about a new national climate survey where region by region, NOAA would actually lay out what the climate would be in a region for the next 30 years. So we really are trying to advance that science, and the government is working to do that too. We are in a compromised situation, and not only because of climate change, as I mentioned. My friend Sandra Steingraber talks about being in a boat, you know, with one oar and a hole in it, and we're bailing, and there's a wave about to hit, and that wave's climate change, and all those other features are the other things. And yet we still have some capacity. There's still capacity there, and there's still the opportunity for restoration, right? There's still that opportunity, and I live by that. It's true. I understand what you're saying, and it's true. Pollinators are on the decline, and we're seeing colony collapse disorder in honeybees. But we have solitary bees, right? We have the mason bees, which I write about in early spring, which are the native bees, super, super efficient pollinators, far better pollinators than the honeybee ever was, better than the bumblebee, for instance. How do we encourage native bees, for instance, in this time? How do we look to bolstering the bumblebee populations? And ultimately, how do we try to solve the honeybee populations too? I don't think my confidence is false, but it does come up against, and it means to, an ideology of fatalism that I think is also being promoted. And that even though, again, I read the science and I understand the science, there's a core belief in me that's not cornucopian, that isn't ready to jump ship into technology and technology to fix it, but does believe in the adaptive capacity that we can build. You know, for some people, that's returning to a very simple life, like a 19th century life of keeping a cow and growing a big garden. And there are elements of that that will be part of the adaptive capacity of this age of warming. There are elements, but it's a progressive, you know, it moves forward in time. It's not a backward return in history. It is informed by history, but it's forward thinking. It's about the future. It's about creating the future.
Amy Seidel doesn't buy the doomsayers who predict a post-human world as a result of a climate catastrophe.
I'm not interested in envisioning a world without the human race. Perhaps it's the hardwired nature of being a mother that prohibits me, almost prohibits me from entertaining that. And I think that it's important for us to look at what might be described theoretically and how sometimes its description can then become conceptualized and real for people. You know, James Lovelock wrote a book called The Revenge of Gaia, which ends in a couple hundred mating pairs of humans in the world. Even Jared Diamond's book, The Collapse, and Cormac McCarthy's fictional book, The Road, I think is promoting... And of course, I'm open to, you know, the free speech of any writer, and I think it's important. But they are fatalistic in my mind, and that's the antithesis of what I want to be writing and promoting in these urgent times. Again, this is not to say I don't understand the science of climate change and believe that we are in a difficult place, and yet I believe in good design. The examination of systems like ecosystems, natural systems that work and that are replicable and self-replicating and resilient. And in rebuilding infrastructure in human society that's based on those designs so that it conveys resilience for us too. That is as good an argument about the future. It's a better argument than one that says we're just about to peter out.
Seidel says we also need to shift our frame from just hoping to save what we can to something more positive.
It's not about salvaging. It's about stewarding, right? You know, in conservation, we've often thought of needing to protect enclaves. And obviously, the larger the areas of conservation, the more robust they are against conditions like we're seeing here. But what I mean to do in early spring is to land the signals of this change in the landscapes that people are familiar with. Right? It's interesting that even though we see the images of the glaciers very often, and they are terrific images of change, it has brought about a geographical distance for Americans about this issue of climate change, when the fact is it's happening right here in our backyards where we can see them. But by actually showing them, by illustrating and describing them in this book, I hope that it engenders this notion of stewardship, especially in families, because there is so much joy and beauty in natural process, in the natural world, just speaking very simply, that if we own and if we see, even in the context of this change, we will be even more inspired to steward. And not to save because of its preciousness, but because of its almost omnipotence over us, meaning it's life itself, and we're a part of it. And that's absolutely essential.
Amy Seidel's book is Early Spring, An Ecologist and Her Children Wake to a Warming World. She's also the Associate Director of Living Future, a not-for-profit foundation and project collaborative to mobilize human genius towards the design of a future that's conducive to life. She's a research scholar at Middlebury College. Go to writersvoice.net for links to Living Future and also to an essay by Amy Seidel called True to Life. Next up, we talk with poet Nikki Giovanni about hip-hop poetry for children. Stay tuned. April is Poetry Month. With April almost over, it's about time we honor it. I suppose I could have taken a very serious highbrow approach and scheduled an interview about very serious highbrow poetry, something you might find in the pages of The New Yorker or an obscure poetry magazine. But when I found the book Hip Hop Speaks to Children in my mailbox here at the radio station, my heart lifted right up. The fact that it's edited by the wonderful and acclaimed poet Nikki Giovanni just made it even better. And the CD that came with the book meant that I could play some of the poetry featured in it for you. It's not just for kids. Hip-hop Poetry for Children, a celebration of poetry with a beat, will delight grown-ups as well as kids, with tracks by Kanye West, Queen Latifah, and the inimitable Nikki Giovanni. Early in her career, she was dubbed the Princess of Black Poetry. And over the course of more than three decades as a writer, she's come to be called both a national treasure and, by Oprah Winfrey, a living legend. Nikki Giovanni, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Now, in your book, Hip Hop Speaks to Children, you say right up front that as long as people have stories, there will be rhythm, rap, and hip hop.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, people tell stories in a cadence, which is how we remember. You know, you think of nursery rhymes. I mean, the reason that they rhyme is so that we can remember. If it wouldn't be for the beat, you know, Jack and Jill went up the hill to get a pail of water. Jack fell down and broke his crown, and guilt came coming after. If we didn't have a beat, we wouldn't remember it. And people have done that forever. So what I wanted to do was, you know, start to connect some of the dots in hip-hop, in poetry, as it were, with a beat. And, of course, we rerolled it back to opera, so I got a big kick out of that.
That's right. I was very surprised by it. You connect it on a direct line to opera. How does that work?
Because we have to remember, you know, opera is a classical art now and is considered actually a bit snobby. But at the beginning of opera, opera came in after the Romans had to quit, you know, the Colosseum was there, but they had to quit killing the Christians and, you know, getting the gladiators. All that's going to be gone because they finally realized Rome is 90% slave, 10% free. If we keep training these people, they're going to kill us. And so they needed to stop, but they still needed something to entertain the people. We have a connection. I mean, there's a history. I'm not a historian. But we have the connections going all the way over to Spain and the Moors. Because the Moors, which you hear today as you're listening in the Arab world to, for example, when an unfortunate thing like a bombing will occur and the women will go, you know, so you have a sort of a chant. And the Catholic Church is going to pick that up because we know that the style of Europe, for example, is going to come out of the Moorish experience of 400 years in Spain. And so the Catholic Church is going to pick up that chant, but they're going to do it, you know, in the, I am not Catholic, so I can't give you a mass, but it's, you know, adi, adi, and, you know, it's in Latin, though, right? Mm-hmm. And Latin is the language of the educated people. Italian was the language of the people, of the everyday people, and it was a vernacular. So as we're getting this rhythm and these chants coming in, and we're trying to say, how are we going to evolve something? We did, and I don't say that, you know, nine old men sat down and did it, but what happened was that we evolved a thing that people always do, which is gossip. And we decided if we can connect these dots, we can make gossip the entertainment. And that's exactly what opera is, if you think about it, whether it's Figaro, 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 or whether it's Aida. I mean, whatever it is, it's all of this gossip about who's doing what to whom.
That's true, it is.
Except that, you know, it's in a language that most people don't understand. And so most people say, oh, that's highbrow. But there's nothing highbrow about opera.
And in fact, it seems that in this book, Hip Hop Speaks to Children, there's a distinct democratic impulse behind hip hop that you're putting forward here.
Well, it is. But again, all origins are democratic. In 100 years, 200 years from now, when we look back with the hip hop, everybody's going to say, you know, it's amazing. I mean, the critics will, how did they know with the hip hop, hippity hop? And they will, you know, explore the way that language was expressed. But right now, we're just going like, yeah, with the hip hop, hippity hop.
What are you waiting for? To the hip hop, the hippie to the hippie, the hip hip hop, but you don't stop rocking to the bang bang, the boogie, say up, jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie beat. Well, skiddle bee bop, we rock a Scooby Doo. And guess what, America, we love you, because you're rocking and rolling with us so much so you can rock till you're 101 years old. I don't mean to brag, I don't mean to boast, but we like hot butter on a breakfast toast. Rock it out. Baby bubba to the boogie, bang bang, the boogie to the beat. Beat is so unique. Come on, everybody, and dance to the beat.
Now, then you go in this book, Hip Hop Speaks to Children, you go into the roots of hip hop and slavery, mm-hmm. and the call and response. Could you talk a bit about that, too?
Oh, see, that's so important because, again, opera itself didn't just transfer itself over to the United States, something like that. But going back to every people have a vernacular, and all vernacular has a rhythm. And as the slaves came, as the enslaved Africans, I should say, as the captured Africans were brought to this nation, one, they had to learn a new language. So they not only, they didn't actually learn English. And, you know, people laugh at the black Americans, you don't really speak English. Well, what they spoke was a vernacular. They had to find a way to talk to each other through various languages. So different words found their ways into the English language. Some like gumbo we know, or some like okra we know, some like peanut we know. You know, there's some things that happen. But mostly the people are going to find a new language, and it's a vernacular. And they're also going to discover another religion, because they're going to discover Christianity. And Christianity is going to become, of course, the metaphor. So when they want to talk about things, if they want to talk about let's run, if they want to talk about freedom, they talk about the River Jordan. I mean, these are things that we all know how that happened. But the preacher, as he is coming up, and now we're, 50 to 100 years into slavery, but as the preacher is coming up, he's going to have to find a way to talk to his people, make a statement, and give them something that they can then repeat to each other and to themselves. If you look at James Weldon Johnson's God's Trombones, those seven sermons, and that's just what survived, or we have that wonderful sermon, The Sun Do Move, that survived. But most of those sermons didn't survive. But the preacher had to put it in a cadence. And so his cadence is going to be the cadence that we now know in the Holiness Church. And he's going to do that. And God stepped out on space, and he looked around, and he said, oh, I'm lonely. I think I'll make me a world. And so the people could repeat that because they're working. And God stepped out on space, hing, and he looked around, king. You see what I'm saying?
I do. That's wonderful. Now, also, there's another part, a detail about how this was used during slavery with what you call hamboning. You say this was connected to Denmark Vesey, the freed slave who planned a slave rebellion.
Oh, yeah. In 1732, Vesey used the talking drum, which I've had the privilege of hearing when I was in Swaziland. They took the talking drum, and they took the drum away because they knew that the drum was saying things that they didn't understand, that the masters did not understand. The same way we did with the Indians when they were going to take the smoke signals away, right? And Indians weren't allowed to do that. You know, you send a smoke signal up, they just kill you, because they knew something was being said. Now, when Morse code comes along, everybody likes it. But the Morse code has been preceded by a whole bunch of things. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so what we had, I don't mean to like, I'm sorry, but see, what we had was now the people don't have a drum. They don't have another way. They don't have an instrument that they had used to communicate with. So the people did what the people always do, because the people are ever inventive. And what they did was they realized, I am a drum. And so they can beat on their chest. If I were with you, they can beat on their chest. That's a ham bone. But so is snapping your fingers is a ham bone. So is that old ham bone, where you been? And you do that, boom, ba-da-dum, boom, boom, boom. And the people found a way to get the rhythm. They also used their feet. And so, they made a big deal out of which way you go in the circle. When you go in the circle, if you go counterclockwise, you're saying one thing, and if you go in clockwise, you're saying another. So the people became a drum.
And did this become a kind of game for children as well?
Oh, everything becomes a game for children, ultimately. And I mean no disrespect on that. But what we do always is the kids, what was serious to us, what we were trying to do to survive, the kids imitate us, and it begins to look like a children's game, but the children are learning something.
Wow. And, I couldn't remember which poem was it that illustrated the ham boning, because I'd like to play that now.
I think We Real Cool. I ham boned We Real Cool.
Okay.
Gwendolyn Brooks.
We real cool. We left school. We lurk late. We strike straight. We sing sin. We thin gin. We jazz do. We die soon. We die soon. We die soon. Yeah, real cool.
And is that also connected to scat and jazz?
Mm, of course, because jazz is all about the feeling. And, of course, Ella Fitzgerald is one of the great scat singers of all time, but Ella didn't know the words half the time. But then when you go back, also, if you go back to King Pleasure, go back beyond, even beyond that, what we had was music, but we didn't really have anything to say. And so what we did was we made up the sound. It's something we've been following all the time, though.
I love the connections that you make in this book. Hip Hop Speaks to Children. And one of them you make to when all the school cuts first went down and gym was being cut out. That hooked right into the hip hop renaissance. Kids mm-hmm. started to break dance.
They did. And of course, you know, break dancing, and I've said it before and I mean it, should be an Olympic sport. Because if we can have synchronized swimming, which is nothing, to be an Olympic sport, that's just nothing but the Rockettes, you know. Breakdancing is way harder. It is a competitive sport, as you know. It requires great skill, great concentration, and an athletic body. And the kids do it, and so it's great. But they didn't have any other physical outlet. And again, you know, you just have to be so proud of black people, because we are just ever inventive. So you take away something that's not like it's okay, because it's not okay, but nobody's going to brood about it. But the next generation is going to say, okay, then what do we have? Let's deal with what we have. It's why we got scratching, break dancing, you know, all of that came from a deprivation.
And it also, another deprivation, we can say, you know, something that women, often hip-hop is not seen as something in which women really play much of a role.
Yeah, but then you have really great women, and God love her, she's a great kid, Queen Latifah, who, you know, breakthrough, and of course we have her in our book, too, with Ladies First. But I remember when the Queen came along, and she said, I want to be Queen Latifah. You know, I don't want to be somebody's girl. And I thought, good for Queen Latifah. You had, of course, Ego Tripping, my poem, but you also had MC Light. So, you know, the women began to say, wait a minute, I have something to say here.
Yeah. Yeah, well, let's listen a little bit to that Queen Latifah. How about that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Ladies, I break into a lyrical freestyle. Grab the mic, look at the crowd and see smiles, cause they see a woman standing up on her own two. Sloppy slouching is something I won't do. Some think that we can't flow. Stereotypes, they got to go. I'ma mess around and flip the scene into reverse.
With what?
With a little touch of ladies first.
I just love that kid. She got robbed on Chicago. She should have an Academy Award.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah, now, talk a little bit about how hip-hop has been kind of, you know, taken over by the music industry in a direction that was so anti-women.
I think that, again, this is America, and anytime we can laugh at somebody or put somebody down, we do. And so, as a group, you can't put black people down anymore. So, you know, you're looking for something that, of course, the gay community catches a lot of it. But also, the women have always, I mean, the blues was all about, you know, my woman is treating me oh so mean, you know. And you have to go through all of that. I think it's regrettable, because I think it's a throwback. And I think, again, and one of the reasons I wanted very much to do this particular book is that I wanted to remind people that it's a public art. And I have to mention it because, and I'm not a negative person, I don't want to dwell there, but you know, what Nelly did could not have been done in a public place. It could only have been done in a studio, because swiping that credit card like that was a fantasy. If he had done that in public, everybody would say, what the hell is wrong with you? Nelly had a credit card and he swiped it on a black woman's behind, and, you know.
Oh.
Yeah. And that was supposed to be clever. Of course, you know, the women protested. We all protested. The women at Spelman particularly, because Nelly wanted to go there and they wouldn't allow it. They would not allow him on campus, and they shouldn't have. But my point being, if this had hip-hop, opera, the church, all of these things are public arts, and if he had done that in a public place, it would have been stopped. But he was allowed to do it because it was a fantasy taking place in the dark. We all know enough about just looking at the Obama administration, and we cheer for that young man. We all know that we have to have more transparency. People have to begin to see what it is coming from. Studio art is very different, as we all know, from live art. Those of us, and I am a big jazz fan, those of us who are jazz fans know you get a way better music. I don't know about the recording. Recording's probably got air and stuff in it. But you get way better music on a live recording.
Yeah.
If Earl Garner had done Concert by the Sea in the studio, nobody would listen to it.
So you're almost saying that it's kind of in that relationship. And you must experience that also as a poet when you're reading your poetry.
Sure.
In the relationship with a live audience, something different happens.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no question about it. There's no question. And speaking of that young man who speaks so very well, when we think about the great Obama speeches, they were all public speeches. When he had to sit down, he did good, but it wasn't that give and take.
Hmm. And we're talking with Nikki Giovanni about a wonderful book, Hip Hop Speaks to Children, A Celebration of Poetry with a Beat, which she put together with Sourcebooks Press. And there are a number of your poems in there also, which we will get to.
Yeah.
But before that, it seems like this is a good time to bring in a poem by James Berry called People Equal. I'm going to play it first, and then I'd like you to comment on it.
Sure.
Okay.
People equal. Some people shoot up tall. Some hardly leave the ground at all. Yet, people equal, equal. One voice is a sweet mango. Another is a non-sugar tomato. Yet, people equal, equal. Some people rush to the front. Others hang back feeling they can't. Yet, people equal, equal. Hammer some people, you meet a wall. Blow hard on others, they fall. Yet, people equal, equal. One person will aim at a star. For another, a hilltop is too far. Yet, people equal, equal. Some people get on with their show. Others never get on the go. Yet, people equal, equal.
I love that poem.
Oh, it's charming. And of course, hearing his voice is so wonderful.
It is. And so tell us about this poem and tell us about the poet, James Berry.
Well, we loved it. And again, we're having a book here for children. And I think there's some obligation to teach. And again, hip-hop gets a bad reputation because they say it's a lot of negativity. But there is some obligation to remind people that tolerance is important. And we have several poems like this. Eloise Greenfield's poem, too. I wrote a poem, Still Got It. You know, we're trying to say to youngsters, you know, we are all the same, but we're different. And it's the concept that takes a minute. You know, you say, well, how can we all be the same? Look at us. Yes, we're all the same, but we're different. But actually, all life is deserving of its chance. That's why we have laws against, you know, beating your dog, or we have laws about how you can slaughter cattle, or any number of things. You just you really just have to recognize that each life is unique and precious. And we're not going to keep everything. It's not going to stay alive. And things happen in life. Accidents happen. But we do try to avoid deliberate craziness, deliberate meanness.
And talking about teaching, you have a wonderful poem, which I will play, but I'd like to have you talk about it. It's a poem called Ego Tripping. There may be a reason why.
Yeah. That's probably my most famous poem. And it's been amazing to me that we have a whole other generation that has fallen in love with that poem, and I'm so glad, because for me, I just wanted to give something actually to little girls that has turned out, which reminds me and everybody else that your reasons are not necessarily what other people's reasons are, because the men like that poem, and I'm glad, because they never exclude it. It's a loving poem. But I wanted to say, I wanted the girls to be able to say, you know, you know how black women have that, and I wanted them to have that, you know, I'm important, you know, I come from someplace, because so much of what we do is so male-oriented. And so it's not anti-male, it's just that I wanted to do something pro the women. And so that's been wonderful.
I was born in the Congo. I walked to the Fertile Crescent and built the Sphinx. I designed a pyramid so tough that a star that only glows every 100 years falls into the center, giving divine, perfect light. I am bad. I sat on the throne drinking nectar with Allah. I got hot and sent an ice age to Europe to cool my thirst. My oldest daughter is Nefertiti. The tears from my birth pains created the Nile. I am a beautiful woman. I gazed on the forest and burned out the Sahara Desert. With a packet of goat's meat and a change of clothes, I crossed it in 2 hours. I am a gazelle, so swift, you can't catch me. For a birthday present when he was three, I gave my son Hannibal an elephant. He gave me Rome for Mother's Day. My strength flows ever on. My son Noah built Newark, and I stood proudly at the helm as we sailed on a soft summer day. I turned myself into myself and was Jesus. Men intoned my loving name. All praises, all praises. I am the one who would save. I sold diamonds in my backyard. My bowels deliver uranium. The filings from my fingernails are semi-precious jewels. On a trip north, I caught a cold and blew my nose, giving oil to the Arab world. I am so hip, even my arrows are correct. I sailed west to reach east and had to round off the earth as I went. The hair from my head thinned and gold was laid across three continents. I am so perfect, so divine, so ethereal, so surreal, I cannot be comprehended except by my permission. I mean, I can fly like a bird in the sky.
What inspired you when did you write this poem, by the way?
Oh, 68. It's an old poem, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, that 68, my goodness, there was an awful lot of things going on then. I remember that year very well.
Yeah, and that was a great year. And I just wanted to, you know, first of all, that was a pejorative term at one point. People would say, oh, you know, so-and-so's just on an ego trip. And it was like, oh, you know, that person is not doing what they should do. And I thought, well, if you're on a trip, you know, ego was probably the best trip because it was also a period of drug use and stuff. And, you know, Timothy Leary and all of them, they were taking trips, remember?
Oh, yeah.
You may not, but, you know, they were doing LSD, and everybody's like, oh, you know, we're going to take a trip on well, Cloud Nine. You know, you had all of that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, no, let's just turn it in and let's look at ourselves. And I had a good time with that because in thinking about it, it turns out actually it's a creation poem. And I hadn't thought about that until I read a criticism of it a long time ago now. But somebody said it is because I was thinking, you know, I wanted to say something to little girls. And so it seemed to me the only logical thing on earth is that women are essential to everything. You know, I never had, in other words, that problem of which comes first, the chicken or the egg. You know, I used to be a philosophy major. I ended up being a history major. But when I was a philosophy major, you know, you'd have these kind of questions, you know, which comes first, chicken or the egg? And quite obviously, to me, chicken. Because egg is 50% chance rooster. And the universe cannot take a chance. The universe has to know how it's going to evolve. So it obviously, you know, it's going to be chicken. But then you think about everything that happened, it had to be a woman there first. First of all, you know, you had a mother. Even when you're talking about things like test tube babies and petri dish babies, you still have to have the egg, and that has to be a female egg.
And isn't it true? I believe it is true that all embryos are female until a certain point where some differentiate. Yeah.
Yeah, everybody starts life as a female. I mean, that's something you can see. And, you know, you can look at your body, your husband's body, and you'll see it all started out this way. And so the anthropological question right now, which everybody's getting a big kick out of, is why do men have nipples?
Yeah.
Well, there's we know why.
Because they started out as women.
Because they started out as women.
All right. Well, you know, your last entry in the book, or the last track in the book, is actually not a poem, but it is a speech by Martin Luther King, the mm-hmm. I Have a Dream speech. Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful, moving piece of eloquence. Why did you include it in a book on hip-hop for children?
Because King, of course, had perfect cadence. And, I mean, that's one of the reasons we remember Martin's speeches is that you can sing it. Almost anything that King preached, you could score it. So he did underscore exactly what I'm saying about this movement. His life was led also in public. He was always in front. He had no curtain to step behind. His life, the 13 years that we knew him, you know, it's so hard to realize we only knew King 13 years from when he was 26, he died, and he's 39. And in those 13 years, he was always out front. But he had this beat. I mean, Martin could probably, Coretta could call him and say, you know, Martin, I need, you know, eggs and bacon and toast. And he would say, eggs and bacon, toast. Yes, toast. I mean, he would, you know, because he just, and his, I just was at a program with Christine Ferris, his sister, And she's the only surviving member of the three. You know, A.D. is dead, has been dead also. And, you know, Christine sounds just like him. It's really funny. But he had this beat. And what I was hoping, because I am not a rapper, I'm just a poet. But what I was hoping was that if I would be crazy enough to try to show that this speech should be rapped, some of the rappers would take it up and really show you how it works out. You know, so it was just, this was an idea that I hoped I could pass along. Because some things get to be sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And when things get to be sacred, they die in many respects. And one of the things that we keep Martin alive is that people have memorized that speech. People know it. And now it needs to go into its second, as T.S. Eliot would say, the second turning of the second stair. It needs another life. And not that it's dying, it's not. But it needs another life that the kids can say, you know, yeah, well, what you said earlier, that the kids can begin to play with it.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, Nikki Giovanni, thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. This is a beautiful book and a beautiful book to listen to.
Hip-hop
speaks to children. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. I'm really so proud of it. So thank you very much.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago,
I am happy to join with you today.
It is obvious that America has defaulted on this promissory note.
Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given a bad check, a check which has come back marked
insufficient funds.
And so we come to cash
a check
that will give us the riches, the freedom, and the security of
justice.
All right.
Let us not wallow in despair.
I say to you, my friend, I still have a dream. We hold these truths to be self-evident,
that all are created equal.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood.
Nikki Giovanni, Ani Lozana, and Val Gray Ward performing Martin Luther King's speech, I Have a Dream. Nikki Giovanni is the author of some 30 books for both adults and children. She teaches at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia. Go to writersvoice.net to hear more cuts from the CD, Hip Hop Speaks to Children.
Hey, Daddy, what that there? And why that under there? And oh, Daddy, oh, hey, Daddy, hey, look it over there. Hey, what they doing there? And where they going there? And Daddy, can I have that big elephant over there? Hey, who that in my chair? And what she doing there? And oh, Daddy, oh, hey, Daddy, can I go over there? Hey, Daddy, what's a square? And where do we get air? And Daddy, can I have that big elephant over there? My quizzical kid, man, he doesn't want anything here. He's forever demanding to know who, what, and why, and where. Inquisitive child, and sometimes the questions get wild. Like, Daddy, can I have that big elephant over there? Don't wanna comb my hair. And where my teddy bear? And oh, Daddy, oh, hey, look at the cowboy coming there. Hey, can I have a pair of boots like that to wear? And Daddy, can I have that big elephant over there?
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.